Welcome into this Five Clubs conversation. I'm Gary Williams. You know I'm a book man. I love to read. I've got a new book for you. It is Rainmaker by Hughes Norton. And for the younger set who might be unfamiliar with him, he was a golf super agent, so much so that he was Tiger Woods' first agent. Well, he worked for the man who created the entire sports agent industry, Mark McCormick. His thoughts on his relationship with Tiger and a host of other historic players like Raymond Floyd, Greg Norman, Fred Couples, Mark O'Meara, the list goes on. What changed? Where we are now with men's professional golf, and where are we going? All of it ahead on the author of Rainmaker, Hughes Norton, right now.
In this split second, your hands make all the difference. It was time for a grip to help them own the moment. Introducing Reverse Taper, technology to stabilize both hands for a more square putter face at impact. The most important split second in golf. Reverse Taper, only from Golf Pride. Respect the grip.
And with that, we welcome in the author. He spent his whole life wanting that to be the preface to his name, the author, Hughes Norton. How are you?
Gary, I'm well. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. You know, your publicist was kind enough to send me an advanced copy of Rainmaker about 2 months ago, and I consumed it very, very quickly because so many of the people that you share stories about in your relationships, as somebody who represented a lot of these people or people that I grew up, you know, watching play golf. And then I reread it again last week, and there were things that I think are indicative of a good book, things that you learn for the first time after reading it a second or third time. Let me start with this. When you have the kind of life you've had and the exposure that you had to so many people in the golf industry, did the thought of writing about stuff like this start 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago? When did it really crystallize in your mind that I want to do this, I'm going to do this?
Very recently, Gary, and that's a great question given all the number of years that have gone by, but never thought about writing a book. I really didn't. In my life sequence, when I got fired by Mark McCormick at IMG, I had a wonderful severance agreement, but it had handcuffs on it to not only not work in the sports management business, but not to talk about or reveal in any way what had gone on in my career. And that lasted 10 years. So now we're at 2008, and 10 years is a long time. And I had any, you know, latent desires to write about my life at IMG had sort of gone away. And I moved on to sort of a quiet life of enjoying my grandkids and playing some golf and just being out of the whole rat race. And then a couple of years ago, and you know this gentleman, Chris Mulhop, who used to work at IMG, now is at Wasserman.
Yep.
He said, Hughes, you know, you really ought to do a podcast. I know this really great guy, Chris Solomon at No Laying Up, and you've got a lot of stories to tell. And I was dismissive, as I always have been, because all during those 25 years, Gary, the media from time to time would check in with me. Hey, I'm writing a book about Tiger. Give me some insights on that. Or tell me about your time with Greg Norman. The Washington Post just did a giant piece on him, you know, within the last year. And this guy was constantly badgering me to do that. And I really always took for rightly or wrongly, I tried to take the high road and thought, I'm not going to say anything. You know, there's no point dredging up, you know, old memories, some of which were pretty painful. So I just said no comment all the way through. So fast forward to 2022. I did the podcast with Chris. And yep. By the way, you know, I'm such a dinosaur. I could barely spell podcast. I didn't know what it meant. I mean, and then lo and behold, I realized how much content is now consumed by the generations, your generation and younger. And for the next month or so, Gary, 15 or 20 times walking around town or seeing people at the club where I belong, hey, that was a great podcast. Really enjoyed that. I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. And didn't think anything of it. Then I get an email one day out of the blue from George Pepper, who I had been in the business with. You know, George was the editor of Golf Magazine. And I was on the other side of the table from George in negotiations for our clients to become playing editors of Golf Magazine or to do books, which George authored. For example, he worked on a book with Curtis and on a book with Greg. So we knew each other. He knew me, friends, adversaries sometimes, but we did that famous 54 holes in one day junket, you know, Andrews, Wingfoot, Pebble Beach. George invited me to do that. So we knew each other. But we've been out of touch for 10 years, as I have been with most of the people in the golf industry, frankly. An email arrives, Hughes, loved your podcast. Is it finally time we did that book together? Sincerely, George. And that was the catalyst. And that was 2 years ago, almost exactly, Gary. And off we go.
There are a lot of wonderful stories in here. I think most of them are actually quite endearing. I think people would say, oh gosh, he's got access to grind. Wait until he exposes this person and that person. I didn't feel that. I think part of it, Hughes, is because vulnerability is part of what makes up all of us. And we all have our own stuff. And a lot of this, I think, is colorful. It's anecdotal. It's not indictments on people. But I also think, and again, this is my psychoanalysis of you at the dime store level. I felt in reading this that you were making admissions about yourself that were pretty damn forthcoming. Could you have made those admissions 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Was this the time that George reached out to you that was the perfect time for you to say, you know what? I got stuff I need to share about me.
Yeah, it's a great point. Curtis, in fact, one of my favorite and longest tenured clients.
Yes.
Very, very important client at that point in my career when I signed him, as you saw in the book. But Curtis, we sent him a manuscript because we were hoping he'd give us one of the blurbs on the back jacket. And he read it and he said, hey, I like this. He said, you know what I like best, Hughes, is how honest and forthright you were. And it wasn't just all the great stuff I did and then I got screwed by a bunch of people. It was, here's where I screwed up. Here's what I did wrong. He said, that really was endearing to me. And he said, that's going to make the book much more authentic. And that's the word, Gary, that George and I really from the beginning tried to live up to. I said to him, George, I'm going to tell the warts as well as the achievements. We got to be real here. Because I want people to know what an agent goes through. It isn't just, you know, $60 million contracts for Tiger Woods on the day he turns professional. That's not really real. It's very unusual. Let's get into the behind the scenes, you know, day-to-day slog that sports agents, specifically golf agents, go through. So we tried to just be real and be truthful and authentic. And a number of people who've read it, and your point is, have said, God, you're awfully hard on yourself.
Yes.
You know.
You are. You are. I don't know you, so I don't know if you're being too hard on yourself. What I'm saying is that you are, whatever veneer you might have had, it doesn't exist in these pages. Your self-examination is critical. It's honest. And it's almost as if there's some type of amends that is being conducted here by you. Is that too strong?
I think so. I never had that word in mind. I just said, let's roll with it, George. Let's go through it chronologically. Along the way, I'll remember a lot of things that happened and sadly forgot some that I probably should have put into the book, Harry. But, and I'm going to just lay it out for you. And he's such a, it's really worth mentioning. If it's a good read and you're testifying to that, so much of that is George. I mean, he's an incredibly talented writer. He's always been my favorite golf writer. And so not only was it perfect for me to have him tell my story because he knew me, but his way with words, his flow, absolutely terrific. And he's, you know, he downplays that, he poo-poos that. He said, oh, you know, I'm just your caddy in this. And it's a lot more than that. And again, back to the authenticity, he knew me all during the period that we're describing. if I chose golf writer X and had never had any history with him or her, it would have been a whole different narrative the way it played out, in my opinion. So that was really important.
There, I want to share that, again, there's a lot in here that I've underlined in the book, but just coincidentally, very early in the book, and you don't spend a great deal of time talking about your relationship with your dad, but you said something that made me smile, but I think is absolutely true. You said, one of the few tidbits of worldly wisdom my father shared with me came out of nowhere one day when he wistfully said, "Hughes, never feel bad when you're alone because you're in good company." It's an excellent, fabulous line. Have you always been comfortable alone?
You know, little did I know what a foreboding that was of my life, Gary, in terms of the breakup of my marriage, Greg Norman going his own way after 11 years with me, Tiger firing me, McCormick firing me. Turns out I am alone a lot, you know, and have been, and it's never bothered me. And I can't tell you those words of my dad were ringing in my ears all these years, but nevertheless, I'm very comfortable. I kid people sometimes. A friend will call me on a Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock, say, "Hey, what's going on?" I say, "You're the first person I've talked to today." He says, "What?" I said, "I haven't said a word. I got up this morning at 7:30. This is the first time I've spoken." And people go, "Whoa, seriously?" So yeah, I've been comfortable with it. Of course, it wasn't true when I was working all those years at IMG, but since, yeah, I never sit around and say, geez, I wish I was still working, or I wish I could still be agenting all these stars, or I wish I could be surrounded by friends. I mean, when I am, I'm great. I have a wonderful time, but it's not part of my DNA, I guess.
For people who might be a little bit younger, who are trying to understand and have context about, you know, what you did, and again, you were such a omnipresent figure in an industry that was exploding, particularly after you signed Tiger, and the acceleration of dollars and purses went to where it did. But I want to give people some context of your life. You go to Yale. You're on the hockey team and the golf team. You get an MBA from Harvard, and you actually, I think, entertain the idea of being either a radio or television gas bag like I am, which would have been interesting because you loved it. There's no doubt you loved doing it, but you got exposed to Mark McCormick because he would come and speak at Harvard's business school, and you were taken by what he was doing. And you had an interlude with him where you drove him to the airport, and that began a dialogue which subsequently turned into employment. When that happens, and oh, by the way, you had an option to go work in the television industry for a titan in Tom Murphy, who I had the great pleasure of playing a few rounds of golf with when I was a young man. Regret, we all have regret. You don't have that many regrets when it comes to that choice, one industry or the other, do you?
Well, a couple of moments after McCormick handed me my pink slip in December 1998, I had big regrets. Yeah. What the hell have you done for 25 years? Yeah, I don't dwell on that. You know, it's the road not taken in life, right, Gary? You can never know what might have happened. Would financially, for sure, it would have been much better for me, because you trace the track the history of what Murphy did with Capital Cities Broadcasting, and he buys ABC, this little conglomerate of television stations. That's a pretty bold move. And then that company is sold in the end for billions and billions of dollars. So one of the things we didn't have at IMG was equity. Mark didn't believe in it. One of the mastermind things, in my opinion, that he did was keep a handful, four or five or six of us, who were driving all the revenue in the business, there for 20 years without any participation or ownership in the company. You know, I don't think it would happen today. Maybe we were all stupid. We were all driven. We were all young, energetic, but we talked to him about it, but he would never relent. But I think probably the thing that made my decision, I think it was subconscious at the time, and I talk about it in the book, was my dad's career in broadcasting had been checkered, to say the least. He'd lost his job and got another job in broadcasting and lost it. And I thought, maybe somewhere in my mind, you know, this is I don't want to go through what he went through. Let's give sports, you know, sports a try. And by the way, you know, when you're 25 years old and you're sitting in an auditorium at Harvard Business School and some guy stands up, remember, if we have 10,000 sports agents today, they were none then, zero. Nobody, the business didn't exist. And here's this guy saying, yeah, this is what we do, and we represent athletes, and we have blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking, wow, who wouldn't want to do that? That's incredible. So what are you going to do? I mean, you think about where you were prior to your own business now, sure, with five clubs and all the things. Maybe you have regrets that at the Golf Channel, something else might have happened, but you just move on, you know, and you've been so successful with it. I'm sure you don't have any regrets. So I think regrets kill you in the end in life. They do. They're terrible. They eat away at progress about going forward. So if I had any, I pretty much dismissed them.
Yeah. I think that's a very practical way of looking at them. And I'm like you, I wouldn't define them as regrets. Do I have decisions that I made that I look back on that I don't want to forget because they're constructive? If something similar is in front of me that, you know, I go, well, gosh, you did the opposite the last time, and I'm with you. It's not a healthy thing to have stewing. Let me read you a line that you said, and I mentioned the name Tom Murphy. For those folks unfamiliar, a really important figure in the proliferation and kind of the consolidation of what was happening with television in the 80s. You wrote, Tom Murphy was unrivaled in our industry, not just for his business achievements, but for his impeccable ethics, his unwavering kindness, and his boundless generosity. Mark McCormick would never be described quite that way. You had some challenging things to say about Mark. Was he a better boss than he was a person?
For sure. And I don't think he was a bad person, but he could never let that out. He was so driven, Gary, so 100 miles an hour all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, driven. There ought to be a picture of Mark in the dictionary, because he really was just boundless energy and enthusiasm for what he was doing, building this conglomerate. You know, he took the luckiest moment in probably anyone's life, when he woke up one day, was part-timing. He was still a lawyer in Cleveland, and he was, you know, doing exhibitions for golfers because he knew a few of them. And lo and behold, about a year and a half later, he's representing Arnold Palmer, Gary Player, and Jack Nicklaus. And as he says, you know, I'd hit the lottery. I mean, that was never, ever going to happen again. So that's a major point in his life. And we talk about it in the book. It's really interesting. Talk about the road not taken. Do I just stay with these three guys and kind of be the Brian Epstein to the Beatles? That's the only guys I have. I can be rich. I can have a lot of fun. They're all my friends that play golf and a lot of golf. Or can I take what I've learned about representing athletes with these three and expand it into fields like tennis, team sports, and all the other things that ultimately happened at IMG? So back to your question. Better boss. He was a very demanding and difficult guy to work for. But he also was, he would recognize achievement and talent within the company and reward those of us who got there. But he was, and in private, I want to say in private life, he wasn't a bad guy and probably was a pretty good guy, but he essentially had no private life. His entire life was work. And growing IMG and more divisions, you know, more revenue, building a legacy. And I wouldn't say he's a great boss or a great, you know, person. He's somewhere in the middle, but I mean, his achievements are legendary.
Yeah, no, he's one of the most important figures in sports history, mm-hmm, because of what he created. And then obviously what the industry became. You know, I'm a believer that, you know, history will educate you about the past, and a lot of times it can explain the present. You have some critical things to say about Greg Norman. Does his history and history that you had direct exposure to give us a better understanding of who he is right now?
You know, probably. Greg was a very stubborn person. He was a very he was a huge believer in his own abilities and what he had accomplished. You know, he starts out as an assistant golf pro in Australia, making $18 a week. And in those days, he was so convinced of his own talent, he would play $1,000 golf matches. And you have to admire that. And he won most of them, frankly. And he developed into a, you know, this global sort of icon. And along the way, whenever things sort of happened around him, he definitely had a trait of blaming other people and holding grudges, and very stubborn. And, you know, I'm straight ahead and whatever's in my way, it doesn't matter. And I think you see that, you know, revealing itself in all that's happened with LIV Golf, for sure. Along the way, acting as he did, you know, he wasn't the most popular guy in golf. Fred Couples was quoted, I think, last year as saying, you know, Greg has been disliked for 25 years, which for Fred, you know, who never says anything bad about anybody, was pretty amazing. But he's a fascinating character, and you have to admire, you know, we talk in the book, Gary, he against my better judgment, rolled the dice with Cobra Golf.
Yes.
When I thought he shouldn't. Again, the risk taker, the young kid in Australia playing for $1,000 when he had $10 in his pocket. He took that risk and it worked. And I think every time one of those things happened, he became more convinced of his, not a business tycoon, but kind of a business magnate and visioned, in my view, you know, business traits or beliefs that maybe he didn't possess. But his confidence was such through the whole process that he's done pretty well. You know, people have speculated, if the Saudis haven't paid him 50 to 100 million already for running the show over there and standing up to all the slings and arrows of hate and objection from the rest of the golf world, I'd be very surprised. So financially, he's hit home runs for sure.
You know, Hughes, it's Greg is interesting on so many levels. He was gutted in ways that if it happened in a couple of weeks at Augusta National, that anybody, particularly a big star, that it would be examined forever. And it's not that what happened in 86 hasn't, or again in 86 with Bob Tway, or in 87 with Larry Mize. And we can go on, in addition to major championship guttings, but also, you know, whether it's Robert Gomez or David Frost. The guy has got, he's got a Rolodex of heartbreaking episodes. And here's the thing. When it happened, I thought that he expressed a pragmaticism that was like, wow. But I always felt, Hughes, that people were like, he doesn't seem bothered enough by these losses. Like, Jack has always been described as the greatest loser. He always, you know, puts a hand out. But with Greg, it was like, this isn't bothering him enough. Do you think he was bothered when those things were happening to a degree that he never exposed?
For sure. I mean, there were cries on the beach with his wife, Laura. You know, you can't go through such devastating losses, plural, right? Without that. I think to his credit, Greg is a great sportsman, tried to keep, you know, a stiff upper lip with the press when it was all happening. But you're not human if it doesn't bother you, and it for sure did.
The whole LIV thing, let's go ahead and get your thoughts on this, because again, your view as somebody who saw how much change was coming, this has been very turbulent to a degree that you can go, well, he's made colossal mistakes and he's made colossal mistakes. Is there one biggest mistake? And if there is one, who's responsible and what is it?
Yeah, I mean, hindsight is so perfect, Gary, as you know. you don't want to jump all over this, but without question in my mind, when the Saudis first came to the PGA Tour and said, we want to invest in the tour, we're very interested in golf. Jay Monahan, the board, whoever it was, in my view, didn't take time to sort of step back and say, okay, do we want to get in a war with people with $700 billion with a B in the fund that they're that they're planning on using to help invest in golf. The flip side of that would have been to say, wow, this is unmeasurable wealth. Think how this can help the PGA Tour. Hey, we'll stay in control, but why not let these guys invest in our product? And they didn't. They took the other route and really pissed them off, you know, throwing them out of the office, essentially, as I understand it. So you want to look back on where this sort of gestated. To me, that's a major point of no return. And of course, the Saudis then said, well, screw you. We'll just go do it ourselves.
Hughes, a couple of things about what you just said. One, just refusing to take the meeting. But even before that, you had the Premier Golf League, which essentially, mm-hmm. they're the ones who kind of created this model, which was then subsequently to a degree kind of taken by the DP World Tour / European Tour to the Saudis in some form or fashion. They evaluated and said, we'll just take it ourselves. So Jay didn't take that meeting with Andy Gardner in the Premier Golf League, is insistent not to engage the Saudis. Is that a combination of insecurity about power maybe being relinquished, or is that an absence of business acumen that's troubling, or is it both?
I think it's all of the above, and it's also arrogance, quite frankly, Gary. I mean, you have a monopoly if you're running the PGA Tour. It's been a monopoly for 50, 60 years. So perhaps you get an attitude of, you know, we're the best. We don't have to deal with anybody else. And I, there's some of that in there, and definitely. It's worth sidebarring here, as we say, to point out that you said that the Premier League, the sports agency in Britain that had the Premier yes. League idea. And in the book, this, in my view, is the biggest revelation in our book, and you'll recognize it. LIV, the concept of a smaller tour with a handful of top stars, not 150 people in the field, with higher prize money, with benefits for players, with a limited schedule so players have more time at home and to focus on the majors, was not invented by these guys in Britain right. or by Greg Norman. Greg Norman, of course, has called it his world tour for decades. Mark McCormick, once again, two steps ahead of everybody else, wrote about this in his book called Arnie, Evolution of a Legend. Mark came up with this idea in 1964, and we spell it all out in the book.
Yes.
A little mini chapter called Live Before Live, because it once again, Mark figured it out, and the person that killed the deal in the 60s and then killed it again later in the 90s when Greg was trying to pitch his world tour idea was Arnold Palmer.
Yeah.
Who said, we can't do this to the guys. The guys, meaning the rest of the tour. Arnold, rare perhaps, but superstar level, had empathy for all the guys that were out there just making a living. And he was not going to be the person, the catalyst that blew this all up.
Yeah, Hughes, I'm glad you brought it up because, again, and I think, you know, Arnold, part of that was absolutely upbringing. His father, his father's, you know, advancement in terms of what he wound up, you know, creating for himself. But it was an arduous life physically. I think Arnie had an empathy for the common man that was uncommon. But that episode that you point out about Mark in this vision of this and the fact that he literally folded it up, and you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, he never spoke about it again, right?
Nope. Well, he when Arnold turned it down in the 60s, you know, I didn't show up till 72.
Yes.
In about 1976, we talk about this in the book, one day Mark called a meeting on a Saturday morning, which was very unusual, and there was no agenda. So four or five of us go into this room, and Mark says, I want to tell you about the second tour. That's what he called it this time around. And we were all going, okay, what's that? And he said, guys, this is for real. He said, the money is on the table if we want to do this. I need you guys to tell me whether today's players would be willing to break away from the tour and do this. And we said, well, what do you mean the money's on the table? He had an airline that was going to be the sponsor and fly all the players around week to week. He had a hotel chain that was going to provide free hotels wherever they were. He had huge prize money guaranteed by those two sponsors and also by the networks. the whole thing was laid out. I mean, the guy is just a visionary. And I remember my mouth dropped open. I was like, this guy is incredible. And thinking to myself, this could work. And the concept sort of was, we, in those days, we would have needed Arnold and, you know, three or four of the other top guys and about 20 other players. That was the size. There were going to be 15 events. And of course, the first thing I said was, well, what about the majors, Mark? I mean, how? And he said, the only major in his view that would ban players would be the PGA of America, because it still had a relationship with the PGA Tour. But he said the guys, and frankly, a lot of players consider that the fourth major in their minds. If you ask any player what two majors he'd most like to win in order, they never mention the PGA.
Right.
It's a great tournament and everything, but it just is sort of
unless they've won the PGA.
Yeah, then it's number one. Don't talk to Raymond Floyd about the PGA. He'll talk your head off. Or Justin Thomas, for that reason. But it was all there, and I thought, and he sort of dismissed the meeting and said, you guys think about it, you know, talk to some players, but for God's sake, confidentially. And then from then on, we never talked about it again. And I'm sure what happened, he never articulated this to me, but I'm sure Arnold, when Mark's talking to Arnold about it again, said, Mark, we went through this once before. And interestingly enough, in 1994, when Greg did this presentation for the World Tour at the Shark Shootout, a tournament that Greg and I created out in California, Arnold was there in the field. It was the 20 or 22 top players at the time. And Greg made this big pitch to the players.
Yes.
And Arnold, this is the third time now, Greg laid it all out. The players are all looking at each other. Arnold stood up and said, guys, you do whatever you want, but I've been through this before. And he looked up at Greg and he said, Greg, how many times do you think Jack and Gary and I were approached about an idea like this? And we would never do it for the good of the game and, more important, for the good of the tour. And then he looked around the room and said again, I don't care what the rest of you guys do. Make up your own minds. It's up to you. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I'm out. And he turned and walked out of the room. Well, even in 1994,
correct,
such respect by the other players in the room. And if I keep knocking this over, we're never going to have a bestseller.
Well, that's why I've got my own copy, got my own prop. You're right. 30 years ago, he shut it down. And it's again, so much of this is, like I said, I mean, history will educate you about the past. I think it helps explain the present. The Norman Tiger, because you not only had those two, you know, here you are, you're representing all the biggest stars in golf and you're trying to satisfy all their needs. And it wasn't just you alone, but you're the guy. The Norman Tiger vibe. What are your recollections about their first couple of interludes? And did you think they had anything in common? Because it appears to me, based on everything that I've read, including the stuff in Rainmaker, there wasn't much there from the beginning.
No, there wasn't. And the first time they got together, I did it. Greg was at home in Florida, had an off week, and Tiger was playing a junior tournament either in Florida or nearby. I can't remember, but he and Earl were down in that area. So I said to Greg first, as I recall, hey, Greg, you know, you've heard about this kid, Tiger Woods. He said, oh, yeah. I said, would you like to meet him? And he said, sure. I said, he's, you know, going to be in the neighborhood here. You think you guys would like to play a round of golf or nine holes or something? He said, sure, I'd love to. And then I told Tiger and Earl, look, number one player in the world, would like to at least sit down and talk to you or play some golf. And of course, Tiger couldn't wait. And so they played, they got together, and I didn't think anything of it. And then I heard that they'd only played nine holes, and I waited a couple of days, didn't hear from either one. So I called Greg, I said, how'd it go with the young hotshot? He said, yeah, he hits it pretty far for a 17-year-old. That was about it. And then I said, okay, well, listen, thanks for doing that. I'm sure it meant a lot to him. And I said, call Tiger, and what'd you think? Tiger said, yeah, the coolest part was all the little short game shots around the greens and stuff. We messed around with that for a while. So neither one was obviously enthralled with striking up a lifetime relationship. And if you think about it, it makes sense. the number one player in the world is always checking out the landscape, Gary.
Absolutely.
Who's coming up? Who's going to be a threat to my domain? Who are the guys I'm going to have to watch out for? So that's a built-in sort of resistance. And Tiger, as self-confident and believing in himself as much as he did, it was cool to play with the number one player, but I guarantee you, in his mind, he thought, you know what? He didn't say this, but he's thinking, I can play with this guy, tee to green. You know, I got to improve my short game. I can see that watching him around. But that really came about to me like, hey, I don't want to be buddies with the number one guy in the world. I'm going to be knocking him off his throne pretty soon. So that was sort of the beginning. And frankly, it went colder from there over time. And one of the reasons I'm pretty sure was when Tiger was playing those 8 sponsor exemptions when he was still an amateur before he turned pro, you know, right at the end when he was 19, 20 years old, people forget this. And it was a real thorn in my side trying to convince Nike and Titleist to pay this kid all this money. He missed 7 cuts out of 8 appearances on the PGA Tour. So all kinds of people that are pretty knowledgeable in golf are saying, this kid's a match player. You know, yeah, he won all these USGA championships, but they're match play. He can't score. Anyway, when Tiger was going through that period, Greg said something to the press like, yeah, you know, it's just another can't miss guy, right? Look at him. He's struggling just like everybody else. So Tiger saw that quote. That didn't make him any closer together. And then, of course, as we've seen in this Live PGA Tour thing, which is what makes the book so interesting to me, is the two protagonists in this war, Norman, Live, and Tiger defending the PGA yes. Tour, are guys that I spent, you know, 20 years with. And who can better recount each of them than the guy that was their agent?
No, it's you. There's no doubt. And the thing about Tiger is that, you know, and I think that, I, in terms of reading your words with George, is that, you know, when you start to have to spend time with him, and I say have to, it was the way things were going, the evaluation of players at a younger age. And he was a prodigy. So there was a requirement for you to you know, do the reach out. He wasn't in college. No, hardly. I mean, he was a middle school kid. And his father, you know, has this very important role, huge role in his life. And I know it's a lot of years removed. Did you ever at any point think that there was something dysfunctional at all about his upbringing?
I didn't. I kind of, as we went along and learned about Earl's first marriage, where he had 3 kids, and didn't seem to be paying much attention to them as life went on after the divorce. And that happens, you know, to people for sure. But I thought maybe this is Earl making up for those days in his first marriage and children with attention and focus on Tiger that he never had time or chose to give to the others. That definitely occurred to me. Only children are frequently different, I think, Gary. Nick Faldo was an only child. People always find quirky things about Nick. Tiger, same deal. We talk in the book, it's funny because Earl was this hard ass, you know, green beret, 2 tours in Vietnam, tough as nails guy exterior. And yet when push came to shove, in my experience in the early years, Tita, Tiger's mom, was the one that laid the hammer down. And she used to tell me, I'd tell Tiger, you don't get A's in school, I put your clubs in the garage. You know, it's funny how those roles are defined. Or play out, I guess would be a better description. Dysfunctional, I wouldn't think so. I did think sometimes, you know, was golf too much kind of shoved down Tiger's throat when he was a little kid? But I mean, I never saw any signs of anything, but he loved it. I mean, he loved every minute of it, couldn't get enough of it. And to this day, would rather hit balls and practice and putt for hours than do anything at age 47.
Well, Hughes, you're identifying, you know, as he starts to rip off, you know, starting with the U.S. juniors and then the U.S. amateurs, and he goes to Stanford, and the wave is going to crest here, and here you are, and he's gonna make the announcement right after Pumpkin Ridge, and you're lining up not decent brands in these categories, the bellwether brands for an obscene amount of, quote, at the time, show up money. Who was the hardest nut to crack of you know, and Titleist, look, you speak glowingly about Wally Uline, and the guy, I've been lucky enough to spend some time with him, and he's a wildly interesting, very, very bright man. They have market principles that they adhere to. Phil Knight, maybe not quite so much, but still, who was the hardest nut to crack to say, look, you got to understand, this guy's different?
They both were difficult in different ways. Wally, because it's a golf company and always had been, and steeped in golf and tradition and legacy, you know, rightfully raised the point I made a few minutes earlier. Hey, Hughes, really? I mean, I've seen a lot of can't miss kids come along and miss. I mean, this guy's played 8 PGA Tour events and he's missed the cut 7 times. I mean, all due credit to the amateurs and the junior amateurs, but come on. Wally's smart enough to realize this was a kind of a once in a lifetime thing, you know, worth rolling the dice on. And also at the time, Gary, Titleist, traditionally a ball company, was expanding into golf clubs. So it was a wonderful opportunity for Wally to use Tiger as a vehicle to launch this line of clubs for better players, which they were in the process of doing. And I think that kind of gave Wally an out with any other players at Titleist who might bitch or moan about how much money supposedly he was being paid. You know, this is a special situation. Nike, on the other hand, it's a crazy place. I mean, people in our organization, the tennis part of our company, had dealt with Nike for years. And before I first started going out there, they told me stories. I mean, it's weird. It's a weird place. It's the people are just different, and they are so, you know, we tell in the book the story. I mean, the Nike campus has so many bells and whistles and benefits for employees, from the cafeterias to, you know, 3 or 4 different types of food and all kinds of basketball courts to running trails and stuff. You know, the biggest problem Nike has, they say, is getting the employees to go home at night. I mean, it's one of those crazy. And they had never been in golf. So their outlook in general is suspicion and sort of paranoia. They're very into themselves and hate agents as a rule. Ironically, Phil Knight in the end hired Howard Slusher. And he's on a poster, which is in the photo section of my book. Howard Slusher was the toughest pro football agent at the time. And lo and behold, Phil Knight, who never said a nice word about an agent in his life, hired Howard to be on the Nike board of advisors. So, but anyway, Nike was a process of, hey, you guys are succeeding in basketball. You're killing it in tennis. You know, you really should get into golf. And they're not so sure, you know, that's hard goods and all that sort of stuff. And anyway, that was an educational process for me. I must have gone there 5 different times, kind of getting the lay of the land and figuring out, you know, what's what. And they, of course, doing their homework on, is Tiger Woods somebody that we want to get involved with? And a bigger question, do we even want to get involved in golf? But my timing there, Gary, was incredibly fortuitous. Nike loved superstars, whether it was Andre Agassi, Jim Courier, Michael Jordan. And those three were sort of winding down in the mid-1990s. So Nike had to now make a move and pick up the next superstar, or in this case, superstar-to-be. So they rolled the dice, you know, and maybe I did a great sales job. Maybe they were smart enough to realize that that golf was the sport they needed to be in. But as you mentioned, the numbers were just outrageous, and I could hardly get them out when I was making the pitch. They were so kind of stupid compared to golf numbers. But I said in the book, the pitch I made to Nike was, look, and there was a guy there named Steve Miller, who was the director of sports marketing. And he was a great guy, and he was very helpful to me. And I'm hoping Steve listens to this podcast. I can't find his address anywhere. He actually last told was running the Professional Bowlers Association. So I'm going to find him because I want to send him a book and I'm going to write him a nice note. But Steve was incredibly helpful, and he was a non-Nike guy. He was kind of like a regular person with all these kind of different people out there. and he was very, very helpful to me. But I said to Steve, look, here's the pitch. Tiger's going to cost an unbelievable amount of money. And here's why. I'm not shopping this. You know, the typical agent thing is I'd take this to Reebok, Nike's offer, and then I'd run it up against Lacoste or whatever. I so believe that Nike was the right place for Tiger that I said, it's a big number for sure, but you guys are used to big numbers. And this will give you Tiger Woods, the dominant force in golf to come. Of course, we didn't know. And they bought it.
The you mentioned Michael, and I think it's important because Tiger really took golf way outside this very affluent, narrow lane. And with you, you know, he burst into the mainstream of everything sports-wise, but also culture as well. And so he became not just a big star in golf, he became a huge star in sports and beyond very, very quickly. Being around him, did he take ample time to understand the opportunity there? Did you find frustration trying to make time to explain to him what was next in the next step, in the next category? Or did he just want to get lost in the pursuit of beating whoever was in front of him?
The latter, 100%. He was oblivious to it. Couldn't care less. He said to me, I think in the middle of the first year, his first year as a pro, he said, all this stuff on the outside, Hughes, all this money, he said, that you're generating, it's paper money. I said, what do you mean? He said, see this check I just won in Las Vegas when I won the play? That's what I care about. It was so, and we talk about it in the book, Gary, that the difference between Greg and Tiger. Greg obviously loved golf, loved to compete, loved to win, and globally an icon. But really, one of the things that drove him to that success, I believe, was the riches and fame and fortune that came with it. You know, the seven Ferraris in the garage and the ocean-going yacht and the private planes and the Gulf Streams and all that. Tiger could absolutely care less about his outside income. And in the book, I point out, this will shock people, all of that money, millions and millions and millions, remember, he had $60 million guaranteed before he teed it up in Milwaukee as a pro. And I say guaranteed, for 5 years, if he missed every single cut, Titleist and Nike had no outs, because I'd purposely structured them that way. And that's pretty unbelievable. And he never once said, Hughes, I just got to take a moment and tell you, those are unbelievable fucking deals. Thank you. Zip. It was like, okay, where do I got to have some time to practice, okay? I want to go over and putt for a while, and then I got to go to the gym. It was... The wealth, the generational wealth theory was actually, this will shock people, it was an intrusion into his life. It wasn't even something neutral. He hated it. The photo sessions, the appearances, the stuff he had to do, and believe me, we restricted those to the absolute minimum. He was making more money from those two contracts and doing less required appearances than Arnold Palmer, who was still very much at the top of his game in terms of outside income. Arnold would have to do many more, you know, photo sessions for company X than Tiger did. And Tiger was making five times as much money as Arnold. I mean, go figure, right? And just once in a while, you know, if you're an agent and you get so lucky as I did or whatever the factors were, and you have a Tiger Woods and you do this kind of work, it's like anybody, you like somebody to say to you, Gary, hell of a podcast. Nice job. That is really, you couldn't have been better today. Never. Nothing. And double barreled for me, McCormick never did that to me either. That's just how he was. Mark would tell other people, I'd get stuff secondhand from other people. Boy, you know, Mark was going on and on. He was about the job you've done building the golf division and signing all these number one. Never, never once looked me in the eye and said, you know, I got to tell you, you know, without you, this company would, or whatever. Is it that hard for people to do? Or was that something about my personality, Gary, you know, as I reflect on this, that people just didn't feel that was something they needed to do to me? So in terms of reflections, maybe I'm off on a tangent here, but.
The relationships that he had, look, teams of people, which we have now in men's professional golf, you know, the physio.
Which I hate.
Yeah, with the, I'm sure.
If I hear, this started in tennis, by the way, folks. Yes. When these 13-year-olds were in a tournament and look up, I want to thank my team. Oh, God, please stop. Now golf, every golfer, Gary.
We.
My team. Are they out there hitting any shots? I don't think so.
Yeah. The we part of it is, I don't know when we crossed that threshold, but my God, we're on the other side of it. Who did he listen to? Did he listen to his father intently when he had to? Did he listen to his dad?
Yes, 100%. Earl was always the factor. Whenever there was a moment where a decision had to be made, or Tiger needed to kind of wanted reassurance, or somebody seconding whatever his opinion was at the time, it was always Earl. And that was one of the challenges. I mean, as I look back on this, I was 30 years older than this kid, and part of my demise, as I believe, as I try to reflect on it, there was some of that in there. It's no excuse. I mean, Michael Jordan had a guy named David Falk who worked for him for years. And mm-hmm. I'd like to point out to Tiger that Michael remains loyal to David Falk, and sadly wasn't to me. But I think the age factor, you know, where Tiger was 20 and I'm 50. And so as the relationship unfolded, even the early years when Tiger was still an amateur, and once he turned pro, I really related to and dealt more with Earl Woods than Tiger. Obviously, some of both, but Tiger perhaps wanted somebody more his age. I'm not sure. He never articulated that. That's me.
Yeah, Hughes, that's another part of this book that people will find interesting is that, look, nobody, I hope, you know, hopes for people to lose jobs. But you were in an industry where it happened habitually. It happened to the best. It happened to you. And look, you're self-critical about what you could have done better, not only for him, but for others as well along the way. He is a very comfortable, confrontational person in the environment where he's best, which is on a golf course. Nobody thrives in confrontation better than him. You pointed out the match play thing. Some people are preconditioned to go, you know, and it's me and you, and one of us is going to get bloody. And I'm okay with me getting bloodied, but you're going to go down, and I'm going to keep you down. I don't think he likes confrontation in other aspects of his life. Is that fair?
Understatement. Huge understatement. He hates it, and he never did it. Whether it was firing John L. Salmo, his first teaching pro in California, or his early girlfriends. You know, the stories of after Tiger broke up with his girlfriend, he'd walk right past her in the hall in high school and never say a word to her. This is how he dealt with stuff. He did it with the lawyer, John Merchant, who negotiated with me on Tiger's IMG representation agreement. He did it with caddies over the years. He did it with me. When it's over, it's over. And there's no discussion. His mind is made up, and there's no, you know, reconsidering, nothing. It's a wonderful point you make. He's so the other way in competition, and maybe he just had enough of that on the golf course and couldn't deal with it. But he, as I say in the book, you know, he told me in front of Alworth that day when he didn't even want me to come down. He called me up and said, I'm going, you know, I want to make a change. I said, well, we got to talk about this, Tiger. This is ridiculous. What? This is the first I've ever heard of this. He said, my mind's made up. I said, I can't accept that. I got to fly down and talk to you. Don't come down here. It's a waste of time. I did, and met him in front of, at the front door of the Isleworth Clubhouse. He told me he wanted to meet there. I thought we'd go inside and get a room, and at least, you know, I've done a pretty good job for this kid. I'd sort of like an explanation before you make this, you know, huge decision. And he said, no. He said, I wish you hadn't come. You know, it's over. And turned and walked away. And he's never said a word to me or tried to reach me or talk to me for 25 years. And that's how he deals with it. When it's over, it's over.
Hughes, the you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation how, you know, when you leave IMG, you've got a non-compete. You basically, you know, go silent. And then you never really reappear. And now here we are all these years later. Was there a period with respect to Tiger that you would have liked to have had? It's not about trying to explain why he might have made a mistake, but just some type of cleansing. Did you hold on to the idea that that would happen 5 years later, 10 years later, and then did you eventually just say, I'm never going to speak to him again?
Yeah, I did. Given his history that we just went over of how yes. he deals with these things, I never expected to hear from him. But Gary, just imagine, Tiger tells me that he's moving on. He doesn't want me in his life anymore. And I said to him, one of the things I did have a chance to say that morning in Isleworth in Orlando was, Tiger, I'm just telling you, it may not make any difference to you, but this could be the end of my career at IMG if you do this. And like, couldn't care less. And sure enough, 2 months later, McCormick terminated me, severance agreement, yes. But again, like the Tiger situation, Gary, no resolution, no sitting down with Mark and him explaining to me why. And I thought that was just like the double whammy of within 2 months of each other. And in the intervening years, all these years really have never had any resolution. So part of that was the book, I think, kind of getting it out. And I didn't expect this, but as we went through the process, I mean, we're working, George and I, on this every week, frequently every day, back and forth, reconstructing what happened, my stories. It was cathartic for me. It really was. It was getting it out. I mean, a shrink would have a field day with this. It was getting out all these unresolved things within me that happened as a result of these terminations. Greg was a different story. I think it's fair to say, you know, I worked for Greg for 11 years.
Yeah.
And almost invariably, I was going to say inevitably, superstars, whatever sport it's in, go off on their own. Arnold's an exception, and there are other exceptions. But just go through the list in our sport. Jack Nicklaus left IMG, founded his own kind of management team. Johnny Miller did it with the guy that worked for him for 6 or 7 years at the beginning of his career. Lee Trevino did it twice. Rory McIlroy has done it in our era. And so I don't begrudge Greg for that. It was hurtful when he ended the relationship with IMG, because we were really good friends. But those things happen. And frequently within a management firm, as would happen with Tiger, relationships kind of come to an end or should be changed, and an athlete will move to another agent in the firm rather than leave. And guess what? That's what Tiger did. So maybe he thought enough of me and IMG to do that. But my great energy in doing this book, and I'm really glad I did it for that reason, because it made me think about things and that I'd kind of pushed aside because they were too painful all this time.
You know, I think about, and Mark Steinberg has been with Tiger, you know, since, and in addition to, we were talking about the team, Hughes, we know who these people are to a pretty large degree. They're content creators. You know, Golf Channel was born, you know, a year after Tiger turned pro. You talk about great timing. But the 24-hour, hey, I know who that is. We know who the caddies are. We know who the physio is. And we know who the agents are. Listen, I remember distinctly the image of you when he won in 97 wearing the not off the rack sport coat with the wavy hair and the cool sunglasses. You were the guy, man. And then you lose your job. Relevancy there's value to relevancy. Some, very little for some, more so with others. And it can be crippling when it goes away.
Well, great points, Gary. And the problem for me is, working as hard as I did, I sort of found myself emulating McCormick all those years and working like crazy and having my family fall apart, worked even harder. So when that happens to someone like me,
yes,
it's your identity is so infused with your job that it's one thing to be rejected at work. It's another thing for people to say, you know, he's the kind of guy I don't want to be with long term. So that was sort of the message from my wife, from Greg at the end, and then from Tiger. So you take those things internally after a while, and it bothers you.
I said at the beginning, I'll say it again. There's so much in this book that'll make you smile, make you laugh. But also, yeah, there are some revealing elements, but I don't think there's anything about gotcha or, oh gosh, I wish he hadn't have said that. But, and you know, whether it's Curtis, whether it's Raymond, whether it's Greg, Tiger, of all the clients you had, who do you think you might have done the greatest disservice to, either for overextending them or underrepresenting them as a valuable brand to whatever degree?
Well, the underrepresenting part I'll do first, because I would never be accused of that. One of the things I was most accused of is pushing people too hard, or being perceived as pushing people too hard. It never happens that way, because the client always makes the decision. But, you know, a regret going way back, you know, Laura Baugh was my first client at IMG, and she was incredibly talented, you know, won the U.S. Women's Amateur at very young age, 16 years old, and then had this wonderful charisma and visual appeal, which IMG fully took advantage of and marketed her to the extreme. And she made a lot of money. But she would frequently say to me, as in those early years, you know, I just don't have enough time to work and practice on my game, because I'm going to Japan all the time. And I know this money is great and it's setting me up for the future, but, you know, should I really be, you know, what's the right choice here? And that's a theme in the book, which you picked up on, Gary, balance, whether it's me trying, you know, a driven personality by nature, trying to succeed in this sort of cutthroat world of agency, and not making enough time for my family, which ultimately cost me, or is it the tour pro? Another example, Bill Rogers. Bill Rogers was a successful player on the tour, but nothing special for his first few years. And then he had a year, and for all you golf
historic
fans out there,
year.
You really should look this up. It's so overlooked. I submit, Gary, it's one of the four or five greatest years in golf history. He won the British Open. He won the Australian Open. He won the Texas Open. He won Heritage. He won Firestone. He won the Suntory Open in Japan. He won the New South Wales Open in Australia. Everywhere the guy went, just something happened. And that one is frequently talked about as the overdue by Hughes Norton, you know, because Bill went all over the world. In those days, appearance fees internationally were huge. And he went all over the world and made a fortune. My defense always was, look, my job is just to create opportunities and present them to my clients. And the beauty of IMG is, because we have so much other revenue and resources, if Gary Williams turns down this particular deal, it's no big, it's fine. Okay, we lost the commission of 20% of $200,000, but we'll make it up somewhere else. And besides, our tennis division's really doing well. It's the agents with one or two clients that are more apt to push their people, in my opinion, to do stuff they shouldn't. But back to Bill Rogers. So I, you know, bore the brunt of a lot of this criticism and perhaps deserved. But Bill himself, and it took a few years, came out and said, you know, I probably shouldn't have done all that, but I knew exactly what I was doing. Mm. And I had a hell of a time doing it. And I set myself and my family up, you know, for the rest of our lives. And I really wouldn't do it any differently. So that is kind of redemption for me when it came a little bit later. But that's the problem in terms of the player feels pushed. And frankly, Gary, a lot of the stuff that IMG was able to develop is so overwhelmingly attractive. I can't tell you the number of times a client would say to me, wow, you know, I'm supposed to be off that week, but how can I turn that down? And that's this. And of course, fast forward, live. I don't care what your morals are or what your allegiance to the PGA Tour is. When someone puts $50 million in front of somebody or more, how do I turn that down?
Yeah, that was one of two last things I wanted to ask you. If you were representing players right now, do you think your stable would be mixed between guys who you would maximize, you know, their marketability and their value? Do you think you'd have some guys at LIV and some guys on the PGA Tour?
I think for sure, because people are always different. But, you know, you followed golf for so long, you know this better than anybody. Golf is, there's such a fine line between huge success and literally losing it. Ian Baker Finch, unbelievable talent. bunch of people told him he didn't hit the ball far enough, changed his swing, ruined his career. Hubert Green, they said, you hit the ball too low. You got to hit it higher. And well-meaning, they make adjustments, but they end up screwing up their. So I think in the back of all players' minds is the thought, you know what? No matter how well I'm doing right now, this could end. And especially now with so many talented kids coming along and year after year having to sustain this level of excellence. And that thought, if I'm a player, would certainly motivate me to listen to a LIV offer, because that kind of money is ludicrous.
Last thing, for the kid who lived somewhat of a nomadic young life before heading to college, and like I said at the beginning, I can tell that you love doing radio. I can tell that you loved whatever shift you got. Any guy who would do the overnight shift back when terrestrial radio and those personalities were massive, massive stars. And then you made the choice. You choose against maybe a life and a career in television, in the industry of television, to represent people. What of all the things you did, what do you maybe miss now? What have you missed in the years since?
I think the excitement of when you, I mean, Tiger Woods is perhaps a bad example because he's such a over and above superstar, but just the fun of dealing with people that you look up to already because they're so talented at something that we all struggle with, and the fun of interacting and selling. I mean, if you have to be able to sell as an agent, we haven't touched on, you know, what characteristics a good agent possesses, but it's almost any walk of life, Gary, same as yours. You know, you've got to be able to sell, and selling is a challenge. And that whole Nike and Titleist approach that I made, I mean, it's exciting and energizing to dream up stuff and then see it come to fruition. So I miss all of that, but I'll tell you what I don't miss. I don't miss the never-ending road trip, you know, the hotels and the airplanes that go with this job. I don't miss working for certain clients that are always complaining or don't appreciate the job that you're doing. I don't miss the inevitable search for the next superstar. Frequently, you identify the wrong people, and so rarely you pick out the right ones. And I also, at the end, you know, IMG became a kind of a dirty word. In sports. I mean, we were the New York Yankees of the 1920s. We were hated by a lot of people. So constantly defending the company that I work for. All of that, as I think back, maybe it's rationalization now, but I don't miss any of that. So, and besides, I couldn't change what's happened. But I am really happy that I could put this down on paper. And, you know, I've said to people, Gary, I want to share with you this. I'm lucky enough, fortunate enough to have invested pretty well and taken the severance agreement that Mark gave me and sustaining a pretty good life financially. There's nothing financial about this book whatsoever. I told this story really for my kids and grandkids to know what I did in life. And I think armed with that approach, it's better. The book is better as a result. There's nothing in there that I'm trying to persuade anybody at or to. You've read it. It's just kind of an authentic, here's what life was like. And what I love, just to conclude, is it's kind of a three-prong narrative. My life as an agent, which we've spent most of this hour talking about, you know, it's pretty cool. If I were not in sports and like golf, I would love to listen to this podcast or read the book. But we do a lot of background on IMG
Yes.
and sports management and how sports management grew because of Mark McCormick. That's interesting to people. And the other part, people don't realize with the billions of dollars in professional golf today, when I went out there in 1972, it was a mom and pop operation. It really was. And we chronicle the stuff that Dean Beeman did. Brilliant, brilliant guy to grow the tour and make this life and this the financial situation that it is today available to these players. So there are three things kind of swirling around in the book. I think you'll agree. And it makes a good read.
It does. It's, again, for people who don't know enough or just simply are not educated on IMG, it wasn't just representing people. It was event management. It was ideation. It was marketing services. It was sponsorship. It became a monolith. And when it did, it then became a three-letter word that people didn't like. Oh God, you know, you're tethered to them. And there's no doubt, Hughes, and again, this is not psychoanalysis. You're sharing with your family. There's no doubt. You're sharing your own vulnerabilities and decisions you had to make and choices that you made and some you didn't. That I think are revealing in a very endearing way. The book again is Rainmaker, Super Agent Hughes Norton and the Money Grab Explosion of Golf from Tiger to Live and Beyond. And it is about beyond. Hard to believe that the kid who gave Mark McCormick a ride back to the airport and you missed the exit, he had to wheel back around. He thought he was going to miss his flight. He's fumbling around with note cards that here you are. And I know you mentioned his name, Chris Mohlhopp. He's told me these years have been spent a lot of reading. You're a voracious reader. And I also know that Gil Hance has tuned up your golf course there in Cleveland. So I know you're happy about that. So life is good, right?
We'll be happier if you come and play and see what Gil did, Gary. I'd love to have a round of golf with you and get to know you a little bit better. But this has been terrific. Thanks so much.
Thank you for doing this again. The book is Rainmaker. It's great to see you. Thank you.
All the best, Greg. Thanks for having me on. Thanks, Gary.
That was great. Very, very good. I'm telling you, look, I could have talked to you, and we will, because I will come and see you because I just want to spend time. There's so much in here. I'm telling you the story about having to go to Raymond's place and pack it up.
That's great. And there's a bunch of things I didn't say in the podcast. I meant to. There's a bunch of stories I didn't tell, you know, and it's funny because the Simon and Schuster's of the world, you know this. They come on. We want the dirt. I ran this book by Rick Riley when I first started.
Yes.
I sent him the sample chapter and his comment was great. He said, I enjoyed it. He said, but you'll never sell it. He said, you should self-publish. I said, why? He said, publishers want the dirt. There's not enough dirt in here. You know, there's not enough really juicy stuff in here. So who knows? But Gary, honestly, you are, I mean, I'm a pretty, I'm a good evaluator of stuff like this. You are light years above other people in just simple vocabulary, how you articulate things. It is a pleasure to talk to you, and I'd really like to get you know you better. You sort of remind me of myself in a way, and really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Let's get Chris, and I'll come out there, and I would love to see what Gil's done to the golf course. I was just down at a new place that, again, you and I could talk about what's happening in the industry of golf, this Apogee project. My God,
yeah.
the gluttony. Now, the golf course is very, very nice, and Gil is, he's so sensible, and he can take flat land, and he can use natural features, and the golf course is very, very nice. But, my God, $650,000 for initiation, a 70,000-square-foot clubhouse over here, $40,000 over here. We got IV drips in the fitness center. What are we doing?
No, exactly. That is crazy. And of course, there'll be a line of wealthy people.
They have a line. They have 300 already signed up. They have no facilities.
Not for me. Thanks.
Well, listen, I know that this is the first or maybe the 10th of many. Enjoy the process of doing this. I know you like talking about it. But again, I loved it. I really did. Take care. It's great seeing you.
You too, Gary.
Okay.
Hope we see you soon.
Thanks. Thank you again to Hughes Norton. Again, the book is Rainmaker that he co-authored with George Pepper about his entire career. And I would say this, is that this is not about his side against somebody else's side, whether it be Greg Norman or Curtis Strange or Raymond Floyd or Tiger Woods. It's not that. It's his story. And his story is really, really interesting. And there is historical context that you gain by reading this book about what IMG became and what it is in terms of the roadmap to how to build an agency for all of sports today. The title again is Rainmaker. The author is Hughes Norton. I thank him. Most importantly, though, we thank you for listening and watching this Five Clubs podcast. We'll see you next time.